Mark 8, verse 27. Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, "Who do people say I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Peter answered, "You are the Messiah." And Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him.
We're a nation of poll takers and survey fillers out and whatnot. We're always asking, what do people think? What's going on? We read our newspapers to find out what the latest consumer price index says about the economy for this time of the year. There are articles about job satisfaction. What jobs do people have that give them the most satisfaction? Or how do other people look at particular jobs? What is the best place to live? What is the best place to retire? What college offers the best education for the least amount of money? And we always check those if we're looking at sending our children off to college. And then come all the polls and the surveys about approval ratings for our political leaders. Is the governor's approval ratings going back up some? What about the legislature? What about Congress? What about the president? And 2010, of course, is going to be a big year for that because, again, with an election year coming up, everybody's going to be asking, what direction are the polls going? It's big business. It's big business for the Gallup poll and the Marist poll, and it's big business for all the spin doctors who have to take surveys and try to put the best spin on it for their particular candidate that they've been hired by. We do it in the faith community, too. We ask the question, what do people think or what do people say? I regularly get an email once a month as information from George Barna. Many people know about him as somebody who does a lot of religious polling and a lot of religious survey work. And it's valuable stuff. And I usually read it and find out, what does he have to say? What are people saying about this part of Christianity or this part about faith? And it's a good question that we should be asking ourselves. And we should maybe do a poll in the neighborhood. What do people in the neighborhood here of church think about Valley Christian Reformed Church? What is our reputation? What is our name? And this is all valuable stuff. You might think that Jesus was interested in the same thing. In the scripture reading we read this morning, Jesus is walking with his disciples and he asks them a question. He says, what do people say about me? Who do people say that I am? And he got a variety of answers when he asked the question. The answer is, some people say you're John the Baptist, come back from the dead. Others say you're the old prophet Elijah who was supposed to come. And others say, well, you're one of the prophets, Jeremiah or Isaiah or one of the prophets that used to be around. But then he comes to the real question. He didn't ask that question just to find out a survey. But he says, okay, now, but what about you? What about you? Who do you say that I am? And that's the question. This morning we start a new, or go back to a series of messages, basically. Back last fall, I had a series on good questions and great answers, and I looked mostly at the Old Testament at that time. Now, till the start of Lent, we're going to be looking at New Testament questions and answers, kind of picking it up again. And I'm starting with this question. Who do you say I am? can read it in Matthew and in Mark. I've used Mark's gospel this time. It's interesting that when you read the gospel of Mark, this question comes right in the very center of the entire gospel. It's kind of a pivot point. Everything kind of leading up to this, and from here on things take a different turn. Jesus is heading to Jerusalem. Notice the very next thing he starts to do after Peter gives his answer, he says that now he starts to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and must be killed and must rise again on the third day. He's heading his way to the cross. It's a pivot point. But the question is so critical. It's a question that each person here has to answer. Not just before we come to communion, not just at the beginning of a new year, but it's the question that has eternal implications. Who do you say that Jesus is? We're going to look at that question and the answer that Peter gives. But before we do that, I just want to highlight something. The first verse that Paul read said that Jesus and his disciples went to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. And that's more than just an interesting little side piece of information. Where does Jesus ask the question? It's not in the middle of Palestine. I remember seeing this in one of the That the World May Know video series we used in adult Sunday school several years ago. Ray Vanderlaan has a whole series of things of walking around Palestine and just giving a lot, tremendous insight into the Gospels and into the Bible from the setting in which they were lived out. And this area called Caesarea Philippi is up in the southern part of what is today Lebanon. And if you remember or have seen some pictures from there, Mount Hermon is the high point in that whole area. It was a big mountain. It still is a very tall mountain considering the rest of the hills and mountains in the area. And Caesarea Philippi is on the southern slope of that mountain. But more important is that this community, this area, the center of lots of different religious influences. It was an early center of the worship of Baal. Now you remember from the Old Testament some of the stories of the Baal gods. It was an idol, a whole series of idols. And they had to do with the fertility rites and how do we get the earth to reproduce itself. And there was a lot of sexuality connected with it. That was centered in the area around Caesarea Philippi. There were like 16, 17 different altars and centers of Baal worship. It was also the place which, according to Greek tradition, there was a cave on the slope of the mountain just outside of what was now Caesarea Philippi that was supposedly the birthplace of the Greek god Pan. Now you remember the Pan pipes? You still play those, kind of a little hand flute type of thing. Pan was considered the Greek god of nature. And Pan would be drifting and floating around. He was kind of a sprightly little character who was out in the woods and had nymphs and all kinds of things around him. It was part of a worship of nature. But also in Caesarea Philippi, there was a big, huge, beautiful temple that King Herod, who built temples all over the place, had built in honor of the Caesar. Because remember the Romans, many times the Caesars claimed to be divine. You needed to worship the Caesar. Caesar is Lord. And so outside there was a beautiful temple built in honor of Caesar where you could worship him and the emperor worship. And it's in that setting where you've got all these different religious beliefs centered. Jesus takes his disciples and asks them, okay, who am I? Who do you say that I am? With all these competing religions, where do I fit? And the question today is just as big as it was when Jesus asked the question in the first place. The answers that they gave in the first question, who do other people say that I am, regarding public opinion, said, well, people think of you as another one of the religious leaders, one among many. Some say you're John the Baptist. Now you remember the stories of John the Baptist. He had a big following for a while. People came all over the place to listen to him. Mark begins his gospel in chapter 1 and talks about how the whole Judean countryside and all the people of Jerusalem went out to him and confessing their sins, baptized. They were baptized by him in the Jordan River. But I remember he was killed, beheaded. And so now people are saying, this is John the Baptist. It's a lot like him, you know. Must be John the Baptist came back from the dead. Others said, no, he's Elijah. Well, what's that all about? Well, if you go back to the end of the Old Testament, first of all, you remember the stories of Elijah was a great prophet and the contest on the Mount Carmel with the prophets of Baal and so on, and the water, the fire coming down from heaven. But at the end of Malachi, the last part of the Old Testament, he says, see, I will send the prophet to you before that great and dreadful day of the Lord comes. Somehow Elijah is supposed to be coming back. Is this what's happening? Is that who Jesus is? And others said, well, I don't know about Elijah, but he's certainly one of the prophets. We really liked Isaiah and Jeremiah. Well, of course, after they died, they were appreciated a whole lot more than when they were living. But now they were looking back and saying, these great prophets of old, you know. And Jesus is another one of them. Well, all of these are people. Elijah, John, Isaiah, Jeremiah. Is Jesus just another one of the great religious teachers? Special people, yes. Used by God, yes. But just people. So who am I? Am I just one of them? In our world today, we have all kinds of religions. And pluralism in our society says you have to make room for all these different religions. And you do. In a free society, there has to be that opportunity for people to follow the different religions as they choose to. We don't have laws that say you have to become a Christian, you have to follow just this one way. That's a good thing in our society. But tolerance, which is important, is something different than acceptance on the same level. And that's where we run into problems, because many people in our society are very willing to look at all religions and say, well, they're all valuable, they're all on the same level. Jesus, Muhammad, Buddha, myself, any other religious leader, any kind of religion, Pan, Baal, doesn't matter, they're kind of all, just take your pick. There's a lot of people, as there were in Jesus' day, who said, well, what works for you? You know, if Jesus works for you, great, follow Jesus. If an Eastern mysticism with reincarnation and becoming one with the universe somehow, if that's what works for you, makes you feel really good, if you believe that, hey, go for it. Maybe Islam works better for you with its strict legal code and enforcing Sharia law in certain countries. And if you want to live in that kind of place, and that's what you need for your society and for your world, go ahead, do it. And if you want the philosophy of many people in the Western world, that figure out your own religion, your own philosophy, your own way of doing things, whatever makes it work for you, good. I'm as good as the next guy. Next person, fine. And so the question comes, is Jesus just on a par with Baal and Pan and Caesar? Is Jesus a good teacher? A man with some supernatural power that he's able to multiply food? Back at the beginning of chapter 8 is the story of Jesus feeding 4,000 people with not much food. And just before this, there's a story of how he healed a blind man at the community of Bethsaida. So who is Jesus? Who do you say that I am? And Peter, as usual, is the first one to answer. And his answer is, you are the Messiah. Or you are the Christ. Same thing. Either Aramaic or Greek. You are the Anointed One. And Matthew adds when he tells this, you are the Christ, the Son of the Living God. Wow. So is that your answer? Who do you say Jesus is? You are the Messiah. Now, that's an interesting answer. Maybe you think about, you've heard probably that a lot of times that Israel was expecting somewhere along the line there was going to be a Messiah, the promised one who was going to come. And the Old Testament points ahead to that. But that most of the people, it seems, were expecting that the Messiah was going to be a political leader. He was going to be the one, at least at that time, who was going to finally get rid of the Romans. We hated the Romans, and he was going to be the one who would take take up an army and force the Romans out. Well, that's mostly true. That was the kind of expectation that was there of Messiah. But there's more to it than just that. And I read in a commentary by Barclay, William Barclay, he expanded the picture, and I think this is helpful to me. I hope it is to you. That during that time, before Jesus was born, in those 400 years or so between the end of the Old Testament, Malachi, and when Jesus came, there was still lots of stuff going on, and there's lots of books and letters and things that were written, apocalyptic literature. They're not part of the Bible, but they're still floating around. And it gave a picture of what the Israelites were really thinking about this Messiah. Because, you know, they knew their history. And they remembered the stories when David was the king. And when David was king, boy, Israel was top of the heap. And they owned a lot of land all the way up into the Euphrates and down toward Egypt. And they were the power to, you know, to stand for. And Solomon followed, and he had that kind of territory too. But boy, this Israel never came back to that. In fact, their history had been one of trouble. The 10 tribes disappeared after the Assyrians came and invaded them, and they never came back. The 2 tribes that were left were taken away by the Babylonians. A few came back at the time of Nehemiah and Ezra, but it never amounted to much. The new temple was nothing like Solomon's temple. And then the Greek-influenced Syrians took over, a time of Antiochus, and again Israel was a captive. And then, well, there was a little blip of when things were starting to go better under Judas Maccabeus, but pretty soon the Romans came in. And the Israelites had kind of given up that they were ever going to be amount to anything. They were just going to always be a small nation. Hopefully they could somehow have some kind of independence. But what about this? Our God is great. And the Messiah is going to come. And God is going to supernaturally invade the world. And that's the only way it's going to work, because our history isn't very promising. And so there were these writings. And they said, there's going to be a time of great suffering, a lot of tribulation. And then Elijah is going to come. And Elijah is going to come to herald, to announce that finally Messiah was going to really come. But when Elijah came, things are going to start getting back together, healing disputes, bringing order out of the chaos of the tribulation. And then Messiah comes. And when Messiah comes, he will be a superhero. He would be the one to whom all of the Israelites, all the people of God are going to flock. They're going to see him and say, I at last. And the nations would look and say, there's trouble, and they would unite against this Messiah. And under Messiah, the nations were going to be smashed. At last, God was just supernaturally going to destroy all those other nations. They would become extinct. The city of Jerusalem would become a great city once again. And everybody would flock to. The Jews from all over the world would come back to Jerusalem. And it would be a new age of peace and prosperity. And everything is going to be good, and it's going to last forever. That was the expectation when Messiah came. And that was floating around all over Israel. But Jesus now comes. And Peter says, you are the Messiah. And Jesus accepts it and doesn't say, no, you're wrong. He says, you're right. But something doesn't fit. Something doesn't fit. Because you see, we just can't take verse 29 all by itself. Who do you say I am? You are the Messiah. Jesus doesn't take that and leave it all by itself either. And Matthew's gospel says, this is what he said to Peter. You know, you're right. You didn't come up with this on your own. This was revealed to you not by flesh and blood, but by my Father in heaven. I am the Messiah. But don't tell anybody. Wait a minute. That's not what you expect to hear. But what Jesus is saying here is they're not going to understand. The time for the plan to be finalized is not yet ripe. Because you see, the Messiah is going to come to be a redeemer, but not with swords, and not with horses and chariots and big armies like you expect. It's going to be something different. He's going to be the suffering servant that Isaiah talked about. And so Jesus says, yes, I am the Messiah. Now let me tell you what that means. The Son of Man must go to Jerusalem, must go to be killed, to suffer, to die. Oh, and on the third day, to rise again. And it's all too much for Peter. We didn't read quite that far, but other than Peter rebukes Jesus, says, wait a minute, this can't be true. That's not the Messiah we expect. And Jesus has to say to him, all right, get behind me, Satan. You just don't catch it. Before we think, oh, well, we would never be that way. If we were in Peter's situation, I suspect we would maybe do the same thing. We see the whole picture. We see the cross. We see the resurrection. We know about the church. We know about all that stuff. Peter didn't see it yet. But this is the whole point. This is the whole thing. Jesus is not just a God like the Baal, bloodthirsty and lusty and doing all kinds of stuff. Jesus isn't a second Pan, a Greek god floating around in nature, enjoying the woods and all the beautiful things and flitting around. And Jesus isn't a competitor to Caesar, matching armies and saying, you got your armies, I got mine, I can beat you. Political power. There are a lot of religions that based on some of those same ideas. That in Hinduism you can become reincarnated. You can become one with nature. Or you can be a follower of Islamic Jihad and forced Sharia law. Or you can follow the Western self-effort philosophy and say, try harder and you can make it. And everybody's above average like they are in Lake Wobegon. And it all sounds good. But Jesus says, wait a minute. Yes, I am the Messiah. But I am the Messiah as the one, the only one, the Son of the living God, the only one who's able to bridge that gap that sin causes between an absolutely holy God over here and sinful people over here. And that puts all of us over here. And Jesus says, I must go to Jerusalem. I must die. Because there needs to be a cross. The only way to get across that gap between the holy God and sinful people is if God puts a bridge. And the bridge is a cross. And this morning we come to communion and we celebrate and remember that there was a shedding of blood. Oh, it's offensive to people. But there was a sacrifice to pay the price. That body and blood shed and broken. That was done so there could be real, eternal life. It's the acceptable, the only effective sacrifice. Jesus is not just another prophet. Jesus is God in human form, taking the curse that's on our sin and removing it, washing it away, wiping it away on the cross. And so the question comes, who do you say Jesus is? Do you say he is indeed God's Messiah? The only way that you or I can become right with God. And so I have to ask you before we come to communion this morning, just take a moment and look in your own heart and ask yourself again that question. Who do you say that Jesus is? And if you can say what Peter said with conviction and with confidence, you are the Messiah. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Then the invitation is there for you to come to the table of the Lord to receive that wonderful gift that he gives. Let's take just a moment. I'll close with prayer.